Hello, everybody. This is David Bixenspan here with part two of running down this year's Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame candidates, along with one Kirk Drummond Brown here on CageSideSeats.com. How are you doing today, Kirk?
I am doing really well. How about yourself?
Good. So I think yesterday we left off with the Rock and Roll Express, and next up we have Ravishing Rick Rude.
He's one. You know, I'm a little ignorant about how he was as a draw, but he's one I think should be in.
I don't know. I mean, he probably wasn't that big a draw, but he was just such a good heel.
Awesome heel.
Yeah, I don't know if he's necessarily someone that a lot of people would vote for, but he was just so good as a heel, even if he wasn't necessarily a big draw.
And I remember when I first saw him as a babyface in the Georgia days, I kind of thought, yeah, he has a cool look to him, but I don't really see him going anywhere. And who would have thought he did the Ravishing Rick Rude gimmick a few years later and was just dynamite.
I guess you could say that's maybe the genius of Jerry Jarrett, giving him that gimmick.
Yeah, that very well could be.
When you think about it, I mean, just as far as just being a great, like, believable heel, he really is up there with the best.
Yeah, he is. He's one of those guys who, one of the things that I remember is the angle where I believe it was Jake Roberts who pants him in the ring.
Yeah.
And there's so many guys who, when they have a gimmick, when they're a heel who's that cool, they will only make themselves have a real bare-assed look on their face. But I'll never forget when Roberts pantsed him, the look on his face was just one of utter embarrassment and humiliation. And I thought it was so cool that somebody who just rides that high on the ego plane with their gimmick was able to, you know, do the exact opposite and really get the angle over. That's the Rick Rude moment I remember the best.
Yeah, and really, I think even now he's still very underrated in ring.
I think so too. It's weird to think he's been gone so long.
Yeah, it's only 10 years now, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe even 11, I think 10 or 11 years now. Oh, no, 10, because he was in WCW for about
a year. Yeah, when he passed away, that was still when I was still rather shocked whenever a young wrestler would pass away prematurely.
You can even say that for the match that he had with Ultimate Warrior to be so good, that should get him in.
That's a talent in itself. Similar to, remember that match Shawn Michaels had with the Great Khali, where he actually made the Great Khali look like a wrestler? That match alone niches Shawn Michaels into any Hall of Fame, in my opinion, and yeah, the same can be said for Rude.
Because the two SummerSlam matches. This was the first one, but he's just so good. You watch him just pacing that match and making sure Warrior never gets blown up. And
that's
it's just
an art
great. Taking all these bumps and selling and just incredible match.
Very true. I didn't put him on my ballot only because of a room, mm-hmm. as is the case with many people on this ballot, but guy, he deserves to be in.
And he's also a guy that I guess he could put him in sort of the same category as Jake Roberts, as a guy who was not the biggest star, but is really well known among people who aren't big fans.
Yes, I absolutely agree. In fact, remember there was that Jim Carrey movie where they made reference to him and Randy Savage, Liar, Liar. Early in the movie, when Jim Carrey tells his son, "We're gonna go see Ravishing Rick Rude and Macho Man Savage, duke it out," and they would imitate the claw hold in that flick. So he's kind of immortalized.
So next up is Sabu, who
if there was a hardcore wrestling Hall of Fame, yes,
or an indie Hall of Fame or whatever,
yeah. But no, as far as one of the things I think of Sabu is I remember when he was getting rave reviews, and I actually really enjoyed watching him. I mean, it was a wild ride watching any Sabu match. But one of the things that stick out in my mind is you know, that brief trip he had with Giant Baba, where he is trying to just wrestle a match. And it didn't, I don't know, he was great being a hardcore wrestler, but in my opinion, if you can't just wrestle a regular 15-20 minute Broadway or a match without pulling out all the chairs and stops, that's not really a complete wrestler, in my opinion. And I don't think that would necessarily exclude you from a Hall of Fame. But he was mainly an indie sensation. I mean, a very special one. I'm, you know, not just any indie sensation. He, you know, he worked his butt off. He did a lot, but yeah, and I don't mean to demean him in any way, but there was something one dimensional about him where he wrestled definitely his style and he wrestled his show. And I think part of being a good pro wrestler is being able to adapt to different styles.
Yeah, I pretty much agree, although I was thinking about this, especially as you're talking about him adapting. I would love to see, I don't think there's a tape of, what was the match? When, like, there was the AAA ECW combined show in Chicago, and it was like him, Cactus Jack, and Psychosis against, who was it, Mysterio and someone?
Did not see that one. I heard plenty about it, but I did not see that one.
I'd be intrigued to see that.
Really?
I mean, it would just sound like an interesting match. Even if it was bad, it would probably be interesting.
Yeah. Well, one thing about Sabu is, again, I enjoy watching him immensely. He is fun to watch. It's just when I think, you know, really good pro wrestler who can carry a lot of different styles, he's in the backseat as far as that goes. I know he didn't have much of a shot in WWE, but then again, you know, it's hard to say. It's hard to say if he really tried to make it in any of the big federations or if he would have gotten over on a bigger level in the regional days.
I think to some degree he would have. He definitely had charisma about him. I mean, was able to carry himself as, you know, doing the madman thing. Well, like his uncle or like Abdullah, and, you know, was a good enough athlete that even if he just did a little bit, you know, 10% or less of what he did, he would have really stuck out.
Yeah, I agree. It's almost like a product of the wrong time is, you know, if he was around in like his uncle's days, I could picture him being a great, you know, sensation going from town to town, you know, like a Sheik or an Andre the Giant, somebody who pops in for a few weeks and splits. I mean, he's watching him is quite a spectacle. And, boy, he's given a lot of his body to the business. But I know I've talked to several wrestlers from the Sheik generation who are really sour on him, mainly because he's somebody who can put on a really good show, but doesn't know how to work an actual wrestling match, would not know traditional pro wrestling psychology. And, I mean, what he does gets over, and he does it on his level, so power to him. But, you know, I've talked to several people who kind of, you know, roll their eyes and say, oh, great wrestler. So, yeah, I definitely wouldn't have him be a candidate in the Hall of Fame, but I do enjoy his work. I enjoy watching him. But as far as, you know, top dog, nah.
Yeah. So next is Masa Saito, who's another one of those guys who I'd be curious to see what region he's categorized in.
I would, too, because he's one of those guys who's been all over the map. When I first started watching wrestling in 1972, I'm probably one of the few people who remember seeing him wrestle as a babyface in America.
Oh, in Los Angeles?
He was the heel tag team with Kenji Shibuya. And a few months into watching wrestling, one night they were doing an angle where Ernie Ladd was coming to ringside to help all the heels with their matches, coach them. And when it came time for Kenji Shibuya's singles match, Ernie Ladd comes to coach him, and Shibuya says, you know, like, get out of here. If I want any help, I'll get it from my cousin Saito. And they proceeded to, you know, before the match was over, by the time the match was over, Shibuya and Ernie Ladd just have this TV set brawl all over the place. And it was the first time I ever saw a babyface turn. And I was like 10 years old, so it was really exciting to me. And it was also the first time I ever heard Gene LaBelle look into the camera, bug his eyes out, and scream, wow! And so Kenji Shibuya turned babyface, and then along with him came Masa Saito as a babyface. Mm-hmm. And oh, and it was great stuff. About 2 weeks later, Masa Saito wrestles Ernie Ladd on TV, and the bell rings, and he takes off his wooden sandal and brains Ladd over the head with it and pins him. Probably the shortest Masa Saito match I ever saw, but it, you know, it was awesome. I also loved, I first started watching New Japan Wrestling in 1983. Mm-hmm. I loved watching Saito work. I especially loved, you know, the tag matches, the six-man tag matches involving people like him and Ricky Shoshu and Animal Hamaguchi. Those were just sheer uncut fun.
That the one big All Japan match he had teaming with, I think it was with him and Shoshu against Tsuruta and I think it was with Tenryu. That match is so good. That match.
I remember that. Yes, yes, that was excellent.
That was like I think that was his only big All Japan match, wasn't it?
Probably there was that was
because he went to jail, right?
What's that?
Because I think that was his only big All Japan match.
Yeah, because that was like mid-80s is when he went off to jail with Patera. Mm-hmm. Another thing he's in a whole different Hall of Fame for, fighting off a trove of police officers. More dubious claim to fame, but quite the memorable one. Match I never saw of his, which was one of the most famous ones, was his island match with Inoki.
You've never seen that.
I've never seen that, and I even forget what people thought of it. I remember the hype for it was just out of this world. Is it one worth checking out?
Not really.
I mean, okay.
It's interesting, but I think I've seen the TV version, and it wasn't very good.
Yeah, when I heard about the hype for it, I remember thinking, in theory, it sounds really cool, but I could picture it not being that alluring. Where, on the other hand, the famous Jerry Lawler versus Terry Funk empty arena match, mm-hmm. even though most people in the business don't like it, all of those hardcore fans thought it was the coolest thing since sliced bread.
But anyway, yeah, so I don't know if it's better to classify him as a Japanese candidate or an American candidate, because, I mean, he certainly was at times a main event level guy in Japan, but he spent a lot of time here.
Yes. I veer toward putting him in, but similar to what you're saying, I'm curious how they categorize him on the ballot.
Yeah, but I mean, definitely, great amateur wrestler too. Although that doesn't necessarily have any bearing, but just
true.
great in the ring though. Probably one of the toughest guys ever in pro wrestling as a legend.
Yeah, he's one guy I would not like to piss off.
Yeah, but I don't know. I guess I'd want to know more about him as a draw in the U.S.
This is true. I mean, U.S., he was usually stuck with somebody as a tag team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really don't picture him being a big draw, not because I don't think he was capable, but I think he was always kind of put in that tag team role.
Yeah.
In Japan, I'm not sure. I mean, I think he was really over there. I don't know how about as a money draw. Yeah. He's one I loved watching work, though, especially in Japan. That's when he really turned it up.
Now, by the way, now, Hiro Saito's not related to him, right?
I don't think he is, no.
Now, is that his real name, though, or was he just given the name because of the resemblance?
I have no idea. I've always assumed maybe it was his real name, because I picture Saito not being an uncommon name. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, but he does look a lot like him, though.
He does resemble him, yes. I mean, there is that possibility. That's, you know, wouldn't be the first time that's been done in wrestling in any country. People are given names to people who resemble him, or
Ricky Steamboat,
or even people who don't even resemble somebody or give him the name.
So next up is Seiji Sakaguchi, who I know is someone that the voters in Japan always tell Dave should be in, but
I believe he should be in. I think his only handicap was being second banana to Inoki for so many years, and there's no way he could have overshadowed that. Mm-hmm. He occasionally came to L.A., and for his time, I thought he was a good worker. And I think he was – I think he was in the limelight enough. I think – let's put it this way. I think he was in the limelight as much as he could have been in Japan. But there's no way you're, going to out limelight Inoki, especially with Inoki being in the driver's seat.
Yeah, I don't really know what to say about him. I mean, I don't know if I would vote for him or anything, but...
Yeah, I wasn't able to vote for him again just because, this is... looking at the people I picked, this is one of 2 years I picked no Japanese wrestlers, which I feel funny about, because all of them are deserving, I do believe. And I know one of the candidates that is just out of my own lack of seeing enough of him was Kensuke Sasaki.
Who's next up on the list, incidentally. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but he's someone maybe now, after he really turned the corner, like, in the last 5 years, and really became, like, it's strange how he just all of a sudden, it seemed like it took him getting away from Riki Choshu and becoming this freelance guy and all that, that he became, like, this big star now. The business...
Which is impressive because more often than not, when somebody breaks away, it usually spells the doom of their career, or they have to come crawling back in some sense,
Yeah, and he also, he has an interesting dynamic, with his wife and with his, Nakajima is supposed to be, either his real or fake adopted son, but, he's been great over the last several years. I just wonder, did he hate Choshu that getting out from under him lit a fire under him and made him enjoy wrestling more?
There's a very good possibility. I mean, I would think when somebody is really held back, or if they're just unhappy with, like anybody unhappy with their boss, if that takes the passion out of something they're doing. And I didn't vote for him out of sheer ignorance, only because I think his prime years are when I was watching the least amount of Japan wrestling than any. I think I'm a lot more familiar with almost every Japanese wrestler, with the exception of Kiyoshi Tamura, on the ballot, other than him.
Yeah. I don't think he's necessarily a Hall of Famer, but depending on how things go over the next maybe 5 years ago, could be. Next 5 years or so, could be.
Yeah.
But it also depends, on how what kind of shape the business stays in over there. But
Now's my time to start watching again.
So next up after Sasaki is Hans Schmidt, who I don't know enough about. I know that he was a very big star. I know that people hated working with him, but that's about it.
Interesting. People, I'm curious because he's one I know that was really, ever since I was a little kid, I remember reading about him in wrestling magazines, especially when I got back issues of 1960s magazines. I mean, he sounded like he had a lot of influence as a heel. I don't know about Hall of Fame. It seems to me he was kind of more Eastern Canadian located wrestler. I don't know if he, like you, I don't know enough about him. I knew he was really over as a heel. He's supposed to be one of the best German, bad German gimmick heels. I'm curious. People hated working with him, huh?
He had the bit of a reputation for being stiff, to say the least.
Okay. Stiff as in unintentionally stiff or bully stiff?
I don't know. I mean, just not as... I'm trying to remember, there's something in J.J. Dillon's book about it. I think, and was it J.J. Dillon's or someone else? No, I'm confusing two different stories. Yeah, I was confusing two different stories because I don't know about if it was bully or just that he just really liked, you know, was one of the guys who either just liked hitting people hard or whatever, but, you know, not in necessarily a safe way, I guess.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of wrestlers like that where people enjoyed watching them. They were box office draw, but, you know, people are like, oh, my God, I have to work with this guy. Like, well, I heard Danny Hodge, who I heard is by no means a mean person, probably one of the toughest people in the business, but I heard he was really stiff to work with and not trying to be a prick or trying to hurt the person. That's just the way he worked. Yeah. Tony Rocco, not Antonina Rocca, but Tony Rocco, who was, a, you know, not a box office draw or anything, was more mid-level wrestler. Yeah. I guess people really admired his work, but he would be really stiff to work with. And even Gordman and Goliath, who were some pretty tough fuckers, would say, oh, dear, Tony tonight, huh? But I guess they loved it in Japan because he was a frequent opponent of Tatsumi Fujinami.
So next up is Sergeant Slaughter, who I think is an interesting person to look at.
He's not on my ballot, but I think he belongs in.
Yeah, me too. I would definitely lean towards him being in. I mean, probably, you know, one of the best, you know, either large heavyweight to super heavyweight guys ever. You know, just big draw. I mean, he did, you know, he did. You still there?
Yes, I'm still here. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm just listening to you.
Yeah, he did deteriorate a lot, you know, after he left the WWF the first time, but he was, sure was good.
He still was good. And yeah, it's similar to the, when we were talking about Kensuke Sasaki a little earlier. It was the opposite for Slaughter, it sounds like. Remember when he left WWF in, was it 1984 or 85?
Yeah, end of 84.
It was like the worst career move he could have ever made, especially when AWA was trying to expand. Mm-hmm. Putting him on TV just, I mean, seeing him on AWA TV as opposed to WWF, bang, it looked terrible.
Yeah, he was good, though. I mean, he... You know, that match with Iron Sheik might be the best match in the history of the WWF.
I love that match. My all-time favorite Slaughter match and my all-time favorite, you know, gimmick match was his alley fight with Pat Patterson. I love that match. Very simple match, but I don't know how many times I've watched it since I first saw it like 20-something years ago.
Yeah, I mean, to me, seeing that match later, I liked the match with Sheik a lot better, but... I do like that match, but I actually like the match they had the month before even better than the alley fight.
I did not see that. What I did see, and what I feel very lucky to have seen, were all the build-ups, the Cobra Clutch build-ups, when people would, you know, wrestlers, usually jobbers, would come in to take the Sergeant Slaughter Cobra Clutch challenge, and he'd clamp the Cobra Clutch on them, and... The way they worked that angle week by week was awesome. It was textbook. You know, it started off with jobbers just getting choked out right away by the Cobra Clutch. And then you had Rick McGraw in there who took the challenge. And they had it where Rick McGraw is in it and is fighting out of it. And you actually think he has a fighting chance. And this was before Rick McGraw did nothing but jobs. He was being put over on TV for the most part at this point, 1981, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And then when they brought Pat Patterson to the groove, and Pat Patterson looked like he was going to be the one who was going to get out of the Cobra Clutch, and, you know, when Slaughter and Grand Wizard just explode on him, the way they built that feud was just splendorous. And that was just like... maybe 3 years before Vince Jr. took the reins and went national, and it's so cool that Slaughter got to be part of that, you know, national expansion when it was huge. And I even remember seeing the matches he had with Iron Sheik in Los Angeles, just house shows. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing in front of the cameras, and damn, they worked their asses off.
Yeah, he was also part of that big run in the Carolinas, too, with him and Kernodle against Steamboat.
That's right. I remember that.
Which is another incredible match, too.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes.
Have you seen that yet, by the way?
I have not seen that one. I saw several of when they were together. I dug Don Kernodle. He's one of those journeymen that, you know, never made it huge, but I always dug him. I liked him watching work. And I liked, what's his face? Who was the other private?
Jim Nelson.
Jim Nelson, who the very first time I saw him, he was just a jobber named Jim Nelson on Georgia TV in 1980. Mm-hmm. I was at the WFIA convention, mm-hmm. and we went to see the Georgia TV tapings. And Jim Nelson walks into the ring, and I'm sitting next to Mike O'Hara, and Mike O'Hara screams, "Oh my God, it's Stan Laurel!" And this little old lady next to him says, "Stan Laurel, I ain't never heard of that guy." And he turns to her and says, "Oh, he used to form a wonderful tag team with this guy named Oliver Hardy." And she just kind of looks at him and says, "Never heard of him neither."
How many of the WFIA conventions did you go to?
I went to two. I went to the one in 1980 in Georgia and 1981 in Houston. Those were really cool. It's a shame those aren't around anymore.
Yeah, it's fun looking back at that stuff. And, you know, of course, leading to, you know, one of my favorite Memphis angles with the Tag Team of the Year deal.
I wish I was at that one. I think that was that the 1979 convention, I think?
No, that was 84. That was 84.
Okay, because I know they went to either Kentucky or Tennessee in 79.
Yeah, I think I had something about that on tape from the TV. Yeah.
Yeah, but in fact, 1979, I was like 17 years old, and I was considering trying to go to that convention, and I didn't, and I kick myself today because that was the first look people got at the Freebirds with Nick Gulas promotion.
Right.
And I remember a fan named Bill Hill, who did a newsletter out of New York, was just telling me about this great group called the Freebirds, and he's just describing them coming to the ring to music and the way they were, you know, just working. And I was like, damn, I think I missed a really good convention.
Now, when did the WFIA end, and what was the deal with, like, the various different splinter groups?
I know very little about the splinter groups, and I'm even unfamiliar exactly when they did end. I want to say they probably finished up around the mid-1980s. They were around for quite some time. I want to say late 60s, early 70s. The earliest actual one I could identify was, I think it was 1972. They went to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And that was, which was the best year you could pick LA for a convention spot.
Did they go? Was that the weekend of the Battle Royal? Did they go? Or
no, they usually went during the summer. Mm-hmm. It was usually July or August. The Georgia one, that was a good one to pick because I got to go to the Omni show that had the famous cage match.
Oh, with Ole heel turn?
Yeah, with where Ole and Gene turned on Dusty Rhodes.
Oh, wow.
That, next to watching Misawa go over Jumbo Tsuruta in Japan live, that was the most amazing crowd reaction I've ever seen to something. I mean, you saw people just chucking beers into the ring, and you saw people crying over Dusty getting taken out. Even saw this kid who must have been in his early 20s, looked like a jock. I mean, didn't look like an unbalanced kid or anything, with tears going down his cheeks screaming, "Dusty!" It was awesome.
Now, being that, I guess, that was the WFIA was considered, was it sort of a, I don't want to say inside, but was it more of like a newsletter reader?
It was like a little bit of an insider's group.
Yeah.
A number of the people, I'm trying to think who was involved. Tom Burke was very active in it for quite a few years.
Howard Baum, Pete Lederberg.
Yes, Pete Lederberg, Jim Melby. I think Norman Keitzer for a few years was heavily involved in it. Lillian Schnur, there's a lot of fans who were really active. Diane Devine, who ran the John Tolis fan club. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they were people who were in the know. I think it was kind of fun, fun for them because that was when you had smarks, mm-hmm. but you still were expected to kayfabe. So, the smarts were kind of in a cool position where they got to know the secret handshake where, you know, now the smarts, everybody gets to be a smart, which is actually cool, but it was kind of fun for them. And I know several of them were pretty good friends with a lot of the wrestlers. I mean, at the Georgia convention, Baron von Roschke actually was out of character when he spoke, which a lot of guys didn't do back then. And I remember von Roschke, you could see that a lot of the longtime WFIA people, he was pretty, you know, good pals with. You know, he's like a really good guy, too.
Now, with the awards, how would it work? Like, would they decide, like, if the side of the convention was decided they wanted to do an angle,
yes,
would they ask them to,
exactly,
ask them to work the winners?
Yeah, I don't think they necessarily did angles with every winner, but they were all dependent on what region they were in. And I think the WFI folk just kind of got together and kind of decided amongst themselves. I don't think there was any, you know, really sophisticated, you know, not like the Meltzer's Hall of Fame. I think it was kind of like, well, who does it go to?
It's just more of a, well, we're in Memphis, who's the top tag team?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. WFIA was a really cool thing. The two conventions I went to, I enjoyed immensely. It was a really fun time.
Okay, so back to the Hall of Fame. Next up is Superfly Jimmy Snuka, who, I don't know, I guess I would say no, but...
I'd say no only because, I mean, he had a good career, but, you know, his own personal excesses kind of, you know, wrecked it. I'm not trying to shortchange him or anything, because before his WWF run, you know, he put in quite a few years, you know, the regional promotions was a huge hit in the Pacific Northwest. I remember, like, even a number of years when I was there, he had been gone from there for a number of years. Everybody still remembered him. But, yeah, I wouldn't quite put him in there.
Yeah, I guess I'd agree. I mean, one thing, you know, that people don't necessarily realize is that, well, wait, he's 66 now, so... He was already 41 when he had the big WWF run first, you know, as a babyface.
Yeah, and he, I mean, it's interesting. He probably would have been a hit for a lot longer if he just wasn't out of control.
Yeah.
You know, of which everybody who follows wrestling, you know, knows about his crazy excesses.
There's one thing, I mean, it's just the way the story goes. I mean, I think I told the same story when I was talking to Rob Naylor during our show about the various Pacific Islanders, but I just love the one story that Mick Foley told, like, second or third hand from The Rock.
Mm-hmm.
On one of those, do you have the WWE On Demand service, the 20, whatever
it's called? I wish I did. God, would I love to have that.
Your cable company doesn't have it?
No, it doesn't.
So they have these roundtable shows, and I forget what this one was about, but Mick Foley's telling this story, that Rock told him, and I don't know if Rock witnessed it or a family member or whatever, but they're looking for Snuka, and they find him in a bathroom, and they tell him, oh, you know, we don't think you should go on because you're too messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And Snuka says to them, you think the Superfly is fucked up? You think the Superfly is fucked up? Then he snorts, now the Superfly is fucked up. He was certainly entertaining in his excesses, you know, between...
Yeah.
You know,
One of the funniest backstage stories I heard about him was... I don't know if you're... There was this interview, and it's one of those ones I know several people remember word for word. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he'd do an interview and he'd talk about an upcoming match.
The Hawaii one are you talking about? About Waller?
Well, what he'd do, he'd describe... that it's going to be something beautiful, like when you look upon the ocean.
Yeah.
And beneath the ocean, you can't see what's under there, but you know it is beautiful. And an old friend of mine who did WWF jobs in the late 80s, Stefan De Leon, mm-hmm. who unfortunately we lost a few years ago. He, one of the times he was doing jobs at WWF TV, it was when Snuka made his comeback in WWF.
Right.
And Stefan was one of these really personable guys who could just talk to anybody and strike up a conversation. Mm-hmm. And he's talking to Snuka, who's, you know, being cordial with him, but nothing special. And then Stefan just says, you know what that reminds me of, what you just said? It reminds me of when you look upon the ocean and you look beneath it and you don't know what it is, but it's something beautiful. And he says, Snuka stops and looks him in the eyes and smiles and nods, yes. Yes, that's exactly what it's like. As if, oh my God, somebody understands what I've been trying to say.
I would pay all the money in the world. Also, I'll send you the transcript if you haven't read it, of that one promo that he apparently cut on Hawaii TV about Lawler.
I would love to see
like
that.
Several paragraphs. Have you read the transcript of that?
No, I haven't. One of the things I'm enjoying about doing this show with you here is. Man, I have a whole list of books I have to read and a whole list of videos I want to check out now. I feel young again.
I've never found a tape of that one, though, unfortunately.
Yeah, Snuka was a lot of fun to watch. I don't know about Hall of Fame, but dug him.
Next up is Wilbur Schneider, who I really just don't know enough about.
Neither do I, and I tried to do reading up on him, and I know a lot of people have passionately argued that he should be in. I don't know. Yeah. It doesn't seem like it sounded like he was a great worker and a great athlete. And I believe he actually owned part of the promotion with a Bruiser at some point.
Yeah, in Indianapolis, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it sounds like he's somebody who got over well in certain regions, but I don't know as far as a long-term draw. For some reason, I never picture him as Hall of Fame material, but maybe I should, you know, read into other people's arguments. I'd love to know the specifics of why people feel he should be in. There might be something I'm really missing.
There's some guys
that I don't – that are in there that I've never seen, and I hate to just exclude them just because I never saw them. So if it's a wrestler I never saw and there's not a lot of footage, you know, I'd love to read up on him and – try to understand the arguments why they should be in.
I think there's some reading material floating around on the internet, so
I'll have to check some out.
Next up is Sting, who certainly feels like he was probably a big enough star to be a Hall of Famer.
Yeah. Didn't put him in, but...
Yeah,
that's a tough one. I mean, yeah, he should be, I guess. I don't know if it's just me, but it seemed like his splash was, as far as overall history, was shorter than most Hall of Famers.
Yeah.
But he was no slouch.
You know, he did give WCW their biggest show ever.
This is true. This is true. One thing is, he seemed like somebody who started off extremely green and really improved quickly, which always impresses the hell out of me. He loses a few points for making that movie he did. Holy shit. Or movie.
Oh, you saw that? Wait, which movie? The one he did while he was in WCW, the movie about his life?
The movie about his life. The what's the title? Where he becomes born again.
I don't know, but I know what you're talking about.
I almost want to sue him for that one for, I don't know, emotional distress. Anybody who tried to watch that one, I see that movie as a tragedy. Didn't vote for him, but yeah, he should be in. He's an interesting candidate. Yeah, because yeah, he was on top. It was in one organization.
Yeah, I mean, but then again, though, he was only really as a draw. I mean, he seems like a big enough star, but he wasn't really a draw for that long. I mean, he was never really that much of a draw until then.
Yeah, and he seemed to kind of more or less opt out of the business a lot sooner than most Hall of Famers would. Yeah. I mean, one exception I would make to that rule is somebody like The Rock, who was in the business for a short time, but the splash he made in the business was just unlike anybody else. Right. I mean, The Rock was just, I mean, unique.
By the way, according to Wikipedia, Sting once worked as Flash Borden, besides just being Flash, which...
No way!
I don't know if that's true. It might be true. I don't
Oh my
know.
God. That's funny. I like that.
But yeah, I don't know. Oh, and what was that movie he made that was like direct to pay-per-view when he was in WCW?
Was it one where he's like a commando or something like that?
That I think there was some other movie. There was some movie that he used. There was like a Sting independent romantic comedy.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, yeah. No.
Let's see if... Let me look up him up on IMDb for a second. I guess I have to look up a Steve Borden.
Because I remember he was in some made-for-TV movie on, I think, TBS as Steve Borden, where he's on a commando team or something like that, a mercenary team.
He was also an episode of Hogan's Show, Thunder in Paradise, too.
That's right.
Let's see. You know, it's always frustrating, though, on... IMDb, when they list all the different pay-per-views and stuff the wrestlers have been on, but let's see, he was in an episode of The Nightmare Room in 2001, an episode of Walker, Texas Ranger as Grangus. Wait, there was Shutter Speed made for TV. I don't think that's the one I'm thinking. Oh, here it is, The Real Reason Men Commit Crimes.
Oh, for a romantic comedy, that's a disturbing title. It sounds like a name of a movie about a stalker or something like that.
Doesn't it? Well, it's
I saw her at Starbucks and knew I had to kill her for the love.
According to IMDb, six bachelors attempt to use their charms and talents to win the hand of a beautiful, sophisticated young woman. Along the way, they each commit a perpetration of the law in attempts to gain the affections of the stunning lady.
Now, I would watch it if the woman was somebody like Mae Young to add a unique twist to the plot, but, oh, Lord, that sounds painful. I wonder who the stunning young lady is.
We have Leanne Bell playing the role of Anne, and this is her only credit on IMDb. I guess she's the lead. I don't know. But, yes, I remember it was direct-to-pay-per-view. And it was like, as they were building up the, like, Sting-Hogan feud, it was like, oh, Hogan's in all these crappy action movies. But Sting's movie, it was at a film festival where it was blah, blah, blah. And that's how they were trying to make Sting a stronger babyface, because he was in an indie movie and Hogan's...
Wow, that sounds wicked good.
And the one review... Wait, actually, there might be more. Wait, there's... Okay, there are two user reviews on IMDb. One gives it 7 out of 10. This romantic comedy is unusual in that it's the first appearance of Steve Borden, and his role is not the action superhero, blah, 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 nothing. Then someone from 2003 saying, stay away from this. I saw it on pay-per-view when it came out. I only ordered it because it was Sting. Anyway, this film, basic romantic comedy, really low budget, bad acting, no story. Anyway. It never came out on video or anything, though. It was only on pay-per-view for a short period.
Even more intriguing.
It was made by, it was shot in Atlanta, of course. Like, Reasonable Productions, which only has the credit for this.
that sounds sadly intriguing. I almost want to see it.
Yeah, it was, I guess someone might have a copy,
Wow.
So... Sting, ladies and gentlemen.
Sting.
Next is Kiyoshi Tamura, who, great wrestler, but I would say no as a Hall of Famer.
I have to play the Volk hand card here and confess that I know nothing about this man.
Okay. Next up is John Tolis.
Who is one of the folks I pick. I doubt he'll get in the Hall of Fame. I think he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I remember... when Meltzer writes about the Hall of Fame, they talk about if somebody wasn't like a draw all over the nation or such and such, one of the things that kind of makes them, as a candidate is if they were a draw in a territory in a unique era, an important era.
Right.
And he did probably the most famous angle in the Los Angeles territory in 1971. That was a year before I started watching wrestling, so sadly I missed out on that.
Yeah.
There is a photo of John Tolis throwing the Monsell's powder into the eyes of Freddie Blassie. But
oh, there is.
Yes, in Theo Everett's book, about 6-7 years ago, there was a book that was released by Theo Everett, a coffee table book. Really good one that I recommend a lot of people check out. And the title of the book is escaping me at the moment. Oh, it's called Exquisite Mayhem.
Oh, this is the one where it's like switches from like wrestling picture to
apartment house wrestling picture.
Yeah.
It's a great book. It has tons of photos from the wrestlers of the LA era, all the way from the 60s up until the Monster. They have a photo of the Monster in that book, fans. Then it has a lot of apartment house wrestling photos, including one that the cover photo that has Sika, the famed porn star, doing apartment house wrestling.
I thought you were going to say he was going to have Sika the Wild Samoan looking on or something.
At least he didn't have Sika the Wild Samoan apartment house wrestling in the nude. Thank God. But man, you just want to scream that the footage was erased of that famous angle when Freddie Blassie won the Wrestler of the Year trophy, and as he was thanking fans, John Tolis reached into the medicine bag of Dr. Bernhard Schwartz. Yes. And threw it in Blassie's eyes and started the most famous wrestling angle in Los Angeles history that led to the famous Coliseum match that drew 26,000 people, which, you know, was, I think, the largest, you know, live gate at the time.
Now, Blassie and Tolis always said over the years that they thought that the show drew more and LaBelle was jipping them.
Yes, I have no idea whether that's true or not, but I've heard a number of people make that claim. LaBelle was well known for being cheap. I've heard several people say that he could have been the next Vince, or he could have been the original Vince McMahon Jr. if he would just spend more money. Apparently, he was a real tightwad and loved to make money. I've even known people who like Mike LaBelle who said his favorite thing to do is to make money. The people who like him would not call him cheap, but they just said he loved to get that capital. I have no idea if that's true or not, but is a possibility. Enough people have said it that I'd entertain that there's some truth to it. I don't know if this had anything to do with LaBelle or not, but when WWF started promoting at the Olympic, and I think LaBelle was still involved with them, there were some problems that people were selling bootleg tickets, and they would oversell the Olympic Auditorium. You'd see people sitting in the aisles, and I don't think they ever knew exactly who was doing it, but there were some people suspected that people inside the game were selling these bootleg tickets.
Yeah.
So, the theory of the Coliseum a little more boost, but I have no idea if it's true. The thing about Los Angeles wrestling back then, it was almost like a working man's Andy Warhol scene.
Mm-hmm.
It was theater of the absurd, but it was so absurd it came full circle and made absolute sense. I mean, this was the most way out thing. One of the angles I heard they did is when Blassie was blinded by the Monsell's powder, he had to actually go to the hospital to get some minor knee surgery done.
Right.
And so he put, like, bandages over his eyes, and, you know, the publicity department would tell people, pay Freddie Blassie a visit to the hospital, wish him well. So they'd go to the hospital and see his eye patched up, and, whoa, John Tolis really did this. And there were even some newspaper reports that, matter of fact, they also said, well, Blassie really is okay. He's going to Japan, you know, and they'll say he's out of commission. But that didn't seem to have any effect on, people loving the angle and embracing it. I mean, being in the hospital with an eye patch over your eye and having people visit you to believe the angle, that's like blue-collar performance art at its finest, in my opinion. Oh, my God. And then the other angle that was great was when Blassie finally returned. From the way I heard it described, he was going after Tolis in the TV studio. And so they said he could only stay if he'd be in the straitjacket.
Right, they chained him to the ring post.
Yes. And I guess the TV show ended with Tolis getting in his face and slapping him and taunting him. And like I said, this is like a working class Andy Warhol. LA wrestling was so unique, and Freddie Blassie and John Tolis, you know, brought it to its heights. The territory, a lot of people say the territory died right after that, but I don't think that's true. It's just that it never grew as well. I think they drew healthy crowds through maybe 1975, 76, and it started going downhill from there. They still had some talented workers, but, you know, the booking was just so terrible, and I got the idea that there probably wasn't a lot of inspiration in the wrestlers. They weren't getting paid that much. And, you know, like I said, you know, yesterday, you know, in the first part of this podcast, LA was unique at its height in that its crew of wrestlers in the early 70s weren't the strongest crew of wrestlers. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. You know, like two of the jobbers I loved were the Peace Brothers, Brother Joseph and Brother Jerome, who were actually the Christie Brothers. And these guys weren't great workers. They didn't have great physiques, but every week I was watching them just because they were so campy. They came in, you know, wearing the leather jackets and were billed from Big Sur, you know, wore the hippie sandals. But LA always had the greatest ring announcer in Jimmy Lennon, the greatest commentator in Dick Lane, and Judo Gene doing the ringside interviews. I mean, they had a stellar crew working the show. And they had some stellar wrestlers like, you know, Ernie Ladd, who was more a stellar heel than a stellar wrestler, then Tolis and Blassie, who were just out of this world. It was a unique time. And even though I didn't get to watch the Blassie-Tolis angle, I did get to start watching LA wrestling when it was still really strong. You know, it was sad to see that territory kind of dwindle in later years. But I got to see some really, you know, cool ones. And Tolis had a lot to do with some of the coolest angles on TV. When I first started watching Tolis, he was actually a babyface, even though he is best known for being a heel.
Right, because they had Blassie come out and forgive him, right?
Yeah, Blassie forgave him. In fact, when I started watching Channel 13 Wrestling, the angle was going that John Tolis was in the hospital because Ernie Ladd started jabbing him in the throat with his taped thumb.
Oh, yeah. I read about this, I think.
And so every week when I would watch wrestling, we'd get a progress report on how John Tolis is doing in the hospital. But, you know, we never saw him. Just every now and then they'd say, John Tolis, he sent us a letter. He's recovering and hopes to come back someday. And Dick Lane did such a good job of hyping John Tolis and making certain people didn't forget his name when he was gone. And when he finally made his return, even though I had never seen John Tolis, I was so excited that I was going to see him, because Dick Lane could tell you that a band of lepers were going to come live at your house. And the next thing you were doing is baking cookies, hoping they would give you leprosy, because Dick Lane made it sound so bitchin'. And so when Tolis came back, he was a babyface. And Tolis, in Freddie Blassie's autobiography, there's some quotes of Tolis saying that he didn't get over as a babyface. I think he was wrong. He was a great babyface in that he was a very unique one. That, you know, he was one of these badass babyfaces who would, you know, come out and bully the heel wrestlers who were bullying the babyfaces. And then when he turned heel, it was amazing, because as a baby face, he looked like this rugged, handsome Burt Reynolds type, who was, you know, a no-nonsense kind of man who would rarely smile and would just talk very seriously to the people, but looked very, almost like a high school coach. And then when he turned heel, he lost a hair match to Victor Rivera, shaved his head, and immediately, when he went on the microphone the following week, his eyes went into beady rat eye phase. And he just, when he talked to the camera, suddenly he showed all his teeth. Like he would open his mouth and make sure people saw his teeth, because he had a lot of gold in there. He had a lot of dental work done over the years. And he also started drooling. And so suddenly he looked like this rugged, handsome individual. And as soon as he turned heel, he just looked like this ugly, rat-faced, you know, prick. He was a great heel. And that was the first heel turn I ever saw. Shinji Shibuya was the first babyface turn I ever saw. John Tolis was my first heel turn, and it was a great heel turn. And he'd be involved in the promotion on and off up until 1980. And then in 1981, I saw him when he was working for Anton the Ripper Leone up in the Bakersfield, Fresno area. And even though he was in his early 50s, he was still a strong interview and still a very good worker, in better shape than most of the people half his age.
Yeah, I actually have on tape. I didn't watch it yet. I was going through all these tapes, converting them to DVD, and they had a lot of Vancouver stuff, and I absolutely told myself I am not going to take the time to convert this stuff to DVD. Because have you seen Vancouver stuff from, like, the 80s?
Yes, I
oh, my God.
This is probably my most embarrassing confession. I wrestled two matches up in Vancouver for Al Timko.
For Al Timko? Really? You worked for Al Timko?
Yes. And I got cut right away because I was too little. And it was very strange watching this very, very soft, ugly-looking man who looked like he had the gout telling me I was too little.
Around
of course, I'm sure this sounds like sour grapes here, but yeah, I can say I was actually fired by one of the worst promoters in the world, and Al Timko.
When was this? Like, around when you broke in?
1984.
Or? Oh, so that was about a year or two after you broke in?
Yes, exactly. My first match was in 1983, and the following year, oh, he was a buffoon. I sent in publicity pictures, and I had long hair at the time. And, you know, eventually I had to go out looking for a job at some point because I couldn't get any work wrestling, or couldn't make much money wrestling other than stuff on the indie scene. So, you know, I had to cut my hair. Tomko calls me on the phone, and he says, "So you got that long hair?" And I'm saying, "Well, no, actually, it's short now." "Well, how long do you think it will grow?" "In about 4 weeks." I'm going, "Not much." "Well, you come up here. We're going to have you be Rockin' Jerry Brown." So a month later, I go up there, and he says, "Your hair is really short." And I'm saying, "Well, I don't know how much hair can grow in 4 weeks." He says, "And you're very little." And I'm saying, "Well, I sent you my publicity pictures, and I didn't bullshit on my weight." And, oh, yeah, he is a strange cat.
Did you end up working his TV at all?
No, I was scheduled to, but that's when he let me go. I worked two matches with a guy named Bernie the Biker, who was actually a really good worker. And actually, you know, I was very green, so he did a really good job in carrying me. But, oh, man. And they had a couple, I must say, they did have a couple of really good workers. A guy who wrestled as Athol Foley, who was actually Bernie Wright, the younger brother of Steve Wright.
Oh, I guess he came over there, like, in between working for Stampede or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, I didn't realize he worked there. I knew
very
that.
Very talented worker and a hell of a nice guy, too. Very friendly, very, you know, very supportive guy. And, you know, wish I could have stayed around a little longer. And of course, Ed Moretti was there, who I've been friends with for like 25 years now, who is, you know, one of the nicest people I met in the biz. But yeah, Al Timko, very strange cat.
Actually, I ended up bringing this up in the first place because I read after I converted the tapes, though, that one of them had Tolis coming in for a brief thing and doing some promo. So I have to find that one and put that
on. I believe that was in 1982 when Tolis went up there because I remember he went up there for a short time, and then that was when I was going up to Bakersfield regularly, you know, taking Dr. Jerry Graham up there for his managing gigs. And Tolis had just got back from Vancouver, and he gets out of his car, which I think was, you know, man, I'm terrible at makes of cars, but it was a big car like a Cadillac. And Tolis says, "Yeah, I just got back from Vancouver wrestling Al Timko." And then he pats his big car, and he says, "Wrestling that guy is like wrestling this car, let me tell you." Tolis is somebody I think definitely belongs in the Hall of Fame. I don't know if he'll make it in there, but man, he deserves to be in there.
And I got to ask you about Altamco a little bit then more. But having worked there just a little bit, even just for just a little bit, how did his operation work? Because I presume he was not drawing, but he was able to keep that territory going for like 10 years after he had really had any named guys. And I mean, did he get a lot of money from the TV deals he had all over the country?
What I had heard, I don't know.
Yeah.
The story I've heard the most, I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard that he inherited some money and, you know, he was by no means a billionaire or anything, but he had enough to coast with. And TV was not just cheap back then, it was free.
Well, the thing is, though, that he had TV, like, all over Canada. Like, even where he wasn't running, because he was on, like, a lot of CBC stations.
Right.
So that would make me wonder, though, if he was getting paid or something, because it's not like I'm guessing he was not a good payoff guy, but...
Oh, he's a terrible payoff guy. But, yeah, he was not a good payoff man at all.
But it makes me wonder, I mean, because he's... Just how much he would... To keep going for so long, though.
That's an interesting question. I was one person who worked Vancouver, whose name escapes me at the moment, who I knew years ago, told me that he had a good stash of money and was able to just keep that territory going, one, by not paying people very much. And while it wasn't a great money-making territory, you know, maybe the way this wrestler put it, it sounded like he didn't lose enough to make it hurt. And I guess he was one of these eternal marks where he was usually like an opening match wrestler. Mm. And suddenly he has his own toy to play with and he can be on top. I remember one match when I was there, he was wrestling Ed Moretti. And that was when, you know, 84, so a suplex was still usually a finishing hold. Mm-hmm. And Ed Moretti gave Tomko a back suplex, and when he lifted him up, Timko screams, Ed, I've never taken this bump before! And Ed says, you're taking it tonight.
And he'd been wrestling, what, for about 25 years by then?
25 years. Actually, I shouldn't say he didn't say I never took this bump. He says, I have not taken this bump in like over 20 years. And Moretti said, well, you're taking it tonight. And he took the bump and he wasn't hurt. And he looked like a little kid who just passed some initiation. You know, the boss of the territory was in the dressing room grinning from ear to ear because he could take that bump.
One of the stories I heard is that he bought the territory, and this, I don't know if this is true, so allegedly that he bought the territory based on, because he had been the AWA promoter in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. One thing that someone told me was that there was one night, like, they drew a huge house, and that he decided to steal the whole gate without paying anyone or paying Ganya the booking fee, and that's how he ended up getting the money to buy the Vancouver territory.
Oh. I've never heard that one.
I don't know how true it is, but...
Yeah, it doesn't... I mean, I don't know if that would make him enough to buy a whole territory.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, well, you know what? I don't think he bought the whole territory at first. I think maybe he bought out Sandor Kovacs or someone at first.
Yeah, that could be. And I know, I think Sandor Kovacs just got burned out, is what I heard.
Yeah.
Maybe he sold it to him for a song because he just wanted to exit.
Really is something, though, that was, I mean, it wasn't one of the biggest ones, but it was a major territory. And in, like, no time, he took it to nothing.
Yeah, he took it from Big the Skeleton Crew. I mean, yeah.
I mean, Don Owen tried to save it for a little while, and I have a little TV from then. It's really good when he sent in his crew, but after that, I mean, it says something when a territory had pretty much two outside guys of any name value come in over the next 10 years.
Yeah, well, one of the things I remember is about Timko was that Don Owens was working with him, and I guess he would really screw with Don Owens wrestlers. Like, I remember hearing that he refused to pay Jonathan Boyd one night just because Boyd forgot to do some minor little thing in a match. Like, he didn't screw up a big angle or anything. He just forgot to do something minor in the match that Timko wanted.
That's not someone who I'd want to stiff on pay.
I would not either. And I can't remember if that's why Don Owen pulled out, or if that was like the straw that broke the camel's back, that he was pulling up stuff with too many of his wrestlers. But he was an interesting individual. He looked like something out of Alice in Wonderland. He just, yeah, Al Timko.
So certainly not a Hall of Famer. But...
No. Well, maybe a Hall of Fame in some, you know, something else, but certainly not wrestling.
So next on the Hall of Fame ballot is Enrique Torres, who I don't know a lot about. I mean, I know about the Torres brothers to some degree. I know they were pretty big stars, especially in Georgia, but not much beyond that.
Yeah, that's how I understand it, too. I'm actually a little embarrassed I don't know more about Enrique Torres, because I've heard a lot of good things about him over the years. I know a lot of wrestlers dug him as an individual, and I guess he was supposed to be a really good shooter. And I think a lot of wrestlers admire that. Plus a good worker on top of being a good shooter. The two don't always go hand in hand. But as far as a Hall of Fame level guy, I don't know about that, really. I always picture him as somebody who got over with his brothers in Georgia really well. But I don't know if I'd categorize him in Hall of Fame. Maybe yeah. Tag Team Hall of Fame?
So next up is Vampiro, the only luchador of Scottish descent greater than yourself.
Exactly. And taking that into consideration, I say no fucking way, like I did with Moolah. He's one of the few who fits into the no fucking way category for me.
Big star for a little bit, but... I mean, he had some okay runs later on, but seems like he was just kind of the right place, right time for a charismatic white guy.
Yeah, and he's somebody who has always struck me as a type who's a lot more interested in getting himself over than anybody else.
Oh, yes.
and from what people say is everything he says, like he could be the forgotten son of Bobby Jaggers, and that everything he says, you have to sit there and say, is any of this true? he's has a cool look to him, and I know he's over gangbusters in Mexico, always has been. But he's somebody who doesn't, from everything I've heard about him, doesn't seem like much of a professional. Is more interested in getting Ian over rather than the wrestlers or the promotion. Somebody who has burned some bridges. And while there's somebody like Conan who was able to burn bridges but was able to mend the necessary ones again, and Conan who was a very keen political player, and, you know, really good wrestling mind. Vampiro has done some of the negative things Conan has, but unlike Conan, he hasn't done a lot of stuff that makes up for them.
So next up is Viano Tercera, who, you know, I think I would say yes, you know, great wrestler for a long time, big star.
I put him in last year. He was on my ballot last year. But this year, there are just too many other good candidates. He's one I really think should be in. He's unique in that he's one of five brothers, you know, with all the same outfit, and he sticks out amongst all those five.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, people in Mexico love Viano Tercero above all the other Vianos combined. So there's a unique charisma. I don't think he's the greatest wrestler in Mexico or anything like that. But he is a draw. I believe he's a draw.
And he was really good. I mean, he wasn't
he was by no means terrible.
Top guy, but
yeah, I don't want to infer that he was bad in any way.
He was great, but he wasn't necessarily among the very best guys in wrestling.
Exactly. But I remember seeing him for the first time in Tijuana. And it was one of those great angles where his mask got torn to ribbons and he gigged the shit out of his face. I mean, he was bleeding from every orifice on his face. Oh, man, as he is famous to do. He was a mess. And it was brilliant. His mask was barely hanging on. You could see over three quarters of his face. And he just got crowd sympathy just beautifully. He's somebody who really should be in, and now as I'm saying this, I'm kind of kicking myself for not including him in this year. He really really belongs in there.
I think I would definitely say yes to him. So next is first Dr. Wagner Jr. and then also Dr. Wagner Sr. as, you know, separate candidates, of course. Dr. Wagner Jr. I would say no, but maybe eventually. Dr. Wagner Sr., absolutely.
Definitely. Dr. Wagner Sr. should be put in there. I am shocked that he's not already in there. Dr. Wagner Sr. is just, I mean, he's one of the icons of Lucha Libre. You know, was a strong worker, you know, somebody who persevered for a lot of years. Why he's not already in there, I'm almost at a loss to say. He is part of a lot of important angles. I totally agree with you about Dr. Wagner Jr. I love watching Dr. Wagner Jr. He is a blast to watch work. I mean, whether he's in Mexico or Japan, that guy's just a hoot. But Dr. Wagner Sr., why he's not in already? I'm amazed he's not voted in.
It really does surprise me that he's not in yet. I don't know. I mean, maybe somehow just the ways that the Mexican vote's been split over the years, I don't know. But I'd be curious to check out what his percentages were over the years, because he seems like such a shoe-in, because, you know, enough probably the younger Mexican voters would be familiar with him, and the older ones would absolutely want it.
Right, definitely, definitely.
So, who knows, you know, I mean, also, you know, this year, with the way that the Mexican candidates are, I mean, he could go in.
I think it's a possibility. I forget how many votes he got last year, or what percentage he got last year, but I'd be very curious to see how it turns out this year. I hope he gets in.
So next is Mr. Wrestling 2, and also then Mr. Wrestling Tim Woods, a separate candidate. Tim Woods, I don't know. I think I'd need to know more, but I think Wrestling 2 absolutely should be in.
Yeah, Wrestling 2 really should be in. Tim Woods, I mean, I've heard many good things about him, but I also heard he didn't get over as well as they expected him to as Mr. Wrestling. Maybe I'm remembering incorrectly, but he seemed like really strictly a regional star. And what I've read about him, he wasn't that strong a star. He wasn't as over as a lot of people hoped. Now, Wrestling, too, I heard it was a total surprise how over that guy was.
And he huge draw, you know, gigantic rate, you know, TV ratings.
Yeah, he's one guy who should be in Wrestling, too.
I think people just don't realize how big a star he was in Georgia.
Yeah, I remember how over he was. that was the first time I saw somebody when I went to the WFIA convention, where I saw a wrestler actually hanging around the hotel lobby wearing his wrestling mask, which is not unusual with Lucha Libre stars, but in Georgia, you know, gave him a real kind of a James Bond aura to him. And all the people at the hotel, the two people, the hotel personnel were jazzed to see, you know, of non-wrestling fans, were Wrestling 2 and Tommy Rich. Like, everybody was like, whoa, look who's at our hotel.
Yeah, I just don't think people realize how big a star he was. I mean, I think I read Dave Meltzer say something when someone asked about, like, which wrestling shows got the biggest TV ratings. I think it was Memphis by far, and then, you know, Georgia during the peak of Wrestling 2.
Yeah. And yeah, definitely.
And, you know,
I think he's like a no-brainer.
Yeah, and was a pretty, you know, pretty decent-sized star in the other territories he went to, like Mid-South. I mean, once he was, you know, in the Wrestling 2 gimmick, I actually don't know, aside from those two territories where he went, you know, of course, you know, with the exception of his WWF run at the end, but yeah, I mean, he was just so over in that gimmick, and he was actually, his WWF run is actually kind of fun to watch, like the different matches he had. Like, he has this very fun match at Madison Square Garden with Terry Funk, and interesting TV match from the Georgia studio with Lester.
Yeah, really brief run, but yeah, I thought it was memorable. I kind of hope he is stuck around. It seemed like they were always pairing him with Terry Gibbs on that run, I remember.
That's too bad for her.
I remember. I remember seeing him also on that TV taping at Georgia, and it looked like he was stiffing that poor jobber that he was working with. I can't remember who the jobber was, but I remember sitting there saying, God, I'm sure glad I'm not that guy right now.
I don't know if I ever watched him, but I remember someone pointing out to me how there are these wrestling team matches where he does look like he's really stiffing guys with a knee lift.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I remember, man. And actually, I know somebody who, I can't remember if my friend worked with him when he was Mr. Wrestling number 2 or if, when he was Johnny Walker.
Yeah.
But is my friend Tom Hankins, who wrestled as Charlie Reed in the South in the 70s, mostly, you know, doing TV jobs and stuff. But his little girl was in the TV studio watching it. Mm-hmm. And she started crying when she saw Mr. Wrestling 2 beating up her daddy. Mm-hmm. And I guess a percentage of the people in the TV studio started booing him to make her happy. And that made him none too happy. And he gave my poor friend the knee lift like he never gave it to anybody before. And that friend of mine actually went up to Johnny Walker a few years ago at one of the Cauliflower Alley functions and mm-hmm. and reminded him of that story. He said Walker was very good-natured about it and was like, oh, I'm so sorry about that.
That's actually a much better story for Tom Hankins to be known for than the
other. Oh, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's a lot better than bragging. I put over the monster for the first time.
Oh, he did? He was the first?
No. I'm saying it's a much better thing to brag about. Who first put over Sal Belomo was the first person to drop to the monster in L.A.
Wrestling 2, I just got to mention before we move on, it's a funny story from a couple of years ago. One of the wrestling promotions, there might actually only be one indie in Hawaii, but they were doing a thing about how Mr. Wrestling 2 was at their wrestling school. And they were doing this thing about how promoting how if you come to our wrestling school now, you might get to be Mr. Wrestling 3 because Wrestling 2's, you know, trying to look for the real Mr. Wrestling 3 because he really wants to make a Mr. Wrestling 3 because I don't have much time left.
Oh, my God. I never heard this.
So, you know, give us $2,000 because then he'll make you Mr. Wrestling 3. Or
oh, my Lord.
And
wrestlers, I swear, wrestlers, no matter how talented and friendly they can be, can still have that that inner charlatan all the way.
And his wife also made some fantastic robes.
I remember hearing about that. Yeah, I remember reading in Ric Flair's autobiography about getting a lot of his nice robes from her.
I think he got all of his robes from her until she died, and then the WWE seamstresses took over.
Yes.
Actually, there's actually someone years ago, he had a site that he had bought the Ric Flair Starrcade 83 robe on eBay.
Oh, no way, really? I wonder how much he paid for that.
I don't remember, but it was...
Whoa.
That was one of the, I think, one of the more interesting wrestling items to go through eBay over the
years.
Yeah,
definitely.
There's been, like over the last couple of years, there was, like, the Bill Watts TV formats, which I would have killed to have gotten, but it was too much money.
Yeah. There have been occasional times where I've seen something for sale where I say... Oh, that's one of the few times I sit there saying, ooh, can't I just win the lotto so I can spend a lot of money on trivial stuff like that? But
I actually was thinking about with that one, though, I should have bought it and when it was still at the buy-it-now price and sold copies.
Yeah, that would have been a good idea.
Yeah, because it was
There have been times I've fought along those lines, but I've never have gone through with it.
It was like $300 for the buy-it-now, and it ended up going for a lot more.
Wow.
Might have been like... And now, like, there's been stuff lately. I read, like, Fritz von Erich's calendars and ledgers or something have been on eBay.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, see, that kind of stuff fascinates me. A lot of those, you know, a lot of the, you know, historical stuff really fascinate me. Like, I would love to be able to look at all those, that Jack Pfeffer material.
Oh, that's at Notre Dame.
Yeah, it's so hard to find, you know, good historical data. And for any kind of a booker or promoter to leave behind every little thing they've scribbled, that's like a gold mine for a historian.
I really wish they offered copies or something, because, geez, I mean...
I know people are getting a lot of material from it. Is it just kind of there in the library and people are going there in person to get it?
Yeah, I think people are just going over to... going over there and just making the copies themselves.
If I had more money, I would take a few days and just park myself in that library and have myself a ball.
Yeah. My local library has some interesting wrestling stuff, like the I didn't send you that, Stu and Helen Hart wedding announcement in the paper.
Oh, no way.
In the same stuff from when I sent you the Cara Daghian clipping from, you know, when he was wrestling in Long Beach, you know, Helen Hart's from here, and I actually have it scanned, so I'll send it to you.
Oh, that's amazing.
Stuart Hart of Canada marrying Helen Smith, and his best man, Al Oeming, and they actually, in that article, they don't mention that he's a wrestler, but...
Oh, how cool.
Yeah, there's some, a few months ago, got a bunch of different microfilm stuff I printed out, and I also copied some stuff from Paul Bosch's high school yearbook because he graduated high school here.
Oh, that'd be cool to see.
Yeah, like a poem he wrote for high school, so some interesting stuff there. And
So he was even writing poems in high school.
Yeah.
Because he published a book of poetry later.
Yeah, he did.
It was called something like A Bit of Me in Each of These or something funny like that.
Anyway, that's the end of the wrestlers list, or at least the list of people being considered as wrestlers.
Yeah.
Because there are several wrestlers on the non-wrestlers list, but when the idea behind the non-wrestlers list is even if they're a wrestler, they're being considered for their non-wrestling accomplishments more than their wrestling accomplishments.
Well, especially somebody like Lou Albano, while he was a wrestler and did get a little bit of fame, would never be considered as a wrestler. I mean, everybody remembers him as the wild, sloppy manager in the WWF.
Did you vote for Albano?
I didn't. And I'm leaning towards he should be in.
I don't know. He seems like if I knew more about before he became Big Sloppy Guy, and if people had seen more of that.
Well, one of the things I think is all of the managers I think of in WWF from, especially the 70s, he was the one that did the least for me.
Yeah, and Grand Wizard was just such an interesting interview.
Oh, my God, Grand Wizard. There was nobody like the Grand Wizard. I remember when they used to air the WWF TV tapings in the mid-70s here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. The Grand Wizard interview stole anything else on that show. They'll say lines like this all the time now, but I remember back then... he's just doing this rant. He's not putting over any particular wrestler. He's just ranting on, how stupid the wrestling fans are. And Vince Jr. says like, how dare you insult these people? These are good people and they hate you. And he says, the idiots who hate me are the same idiots who voted for Nixon twice. And I'd never heard a wrestler say anything political like that. And I just said, this dude is awesome.
He had a way with words, because there's also one that's on like one of the WWF Coliseum videos. That's when Vince is telling him about, oh, how can you say the fans love you when they're booing? And he's like, the boos must be from booze, because you can you can only think that from imbibing.
Exactly, yes. That was back in the days when the managers pretty much improvised most of their interviews rather than read a script, and I thought he was very, very good at it. And also I loved how the only part of his face that was showing was his mouth. But he used that mouth as if he were a villain in a Speed Racer cartoon with that maniacal smile. He was awesome. And Blassie, I thought, was great as a manager also. And Albano was kind of fun, but I was never strong on him.
What was I saying about Grand Wizard? I just thought of it now because it's the way that he, like, sort of talked and the big words and stuff. It's almost like he was sort of a weird, like, psychedelic Bachwinkle with his promos.
That's a great way to describe him. I like that.
And there's something I've asked people, and I've never gotten an answer. I was curious if you might know. Did, as far as, you know, he comes to WWF, he had been Abdullah for Farouk, he's doing basically the same gimmick, they call him the Grand Wizard. Was mm-hmm. it supposed to be a rib based on Grand Wizard being a KKK ranking and him being a gay Jew?
Probably, and from looking at the tone of skin, looks like there could have been a little Middle Eastern blood in there, too. I thought it had to be a rib.
Okay.
Yeah, because very Jewish, very gay, you know, and, you know, love to smoke dope and pop pills and have a great time. So everything opposite of the KKK.
So next up on the non-wrestlers list is Jim Crockett Jr., who, very interesting candidate because even, you know, he did lose out to Vince in the end, but he was so successful. I mean, no one came close to him as far as territories at the end there.
I put him on. This is one of the few times where I felt almost like I'm not worthy to be voting on this stuff because I should be more aware of Jim Crockett Jr. than I am, or I should know more about him. I mean, somebody so instrumental in a territory in his day. But I did pick him. You know, nice thing about the non-wrestler list is you could just pick them all or pick none of them. It's great. I think I picked most of them.
Yeah, I think it was in the Observer a couple weeks ago, Dave Meltzer mentioned that in 1986, which, you know, was the biggest year ever for any NWA promotion, Crockett drew more paid admissions than WWE will this year.
Mm-hmm.
Which, the business has changed a lot, but that's still one promotion. I mean,
yeah.
You usually hear comparisons about the whole country. That, you know, that's one NWA promotion, and they were touring around some, like, into, you know, places that weren't, you know, main Crockett-type cities, but they were still based mainly around the Crockett base, at, you know, in Georgia, and they were on fire.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and it was under him that, you know, that it became pretty much the best, you know, the showcase NWA promotion. You know, so...
Yeah, this is true. And man, as you can tell by my lack of response, I know so little about the story behind him. I know what an important figure he was. When you think NWA in its prime, you know, before, you know, when it was still the regional days, I mean, that was the daddy.
And as Gary Hart put it, like, you know, who, and like, I guess, you know, once Crockett, you know, was such, you know, was the top promotion, that the only two territories with a waiting list were Crockett and WWF.
Wow, I did not realize that.
To get into.
Speaking of great candidates, Gary Hart.
Yeah, who's next? Oh, man, absolutely.
I never fully appreciated Gary Hart until I saw the Heroes of World Class DVD a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I think you and I were talking about this. He stole that show. He stole that Heroes of World Class DVD. I was a lot less interested in the actual subject of the DVD after it was over than I was Gary Hart. I just wanted to hear this guy discuss wrestling, and that's the next book I'm looking forward to reading, is Gary Hart's book.
Great manager, great promo, also very successful booker, too. You know?
He's such a great analytical mind as far as booking. I mean, somebody who you tell from day one was doing his homework. Man, I predict he will get in. With no problem. I think he's a shoo-in.
Yeah, also just very, you know, very different from most managers, too, because, you know, he was really behind the scenes helping them develop their gimmicks and everything. Just, you know, he wasn't just, you know, a mouthpiece.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. No, he's somebody who understood booking a territory. He knew somebody who understood booking it from top to bottom. I mean, occasionally you'll hear about bookers who were just really good minds. Like, I remember hearing when Masked Superstar was booking Georgia and when Leo Garibaldi would book L.A., that these were the type of bookers who, even though they had 101 things to do, they watched everything from the opening match to the final, you know, to the main event and the blow-off match at the end. You know, something all bookers should do, but not all will do.
Leo Garibaldi's a guy I wish I knew more about.
Yeah, I know quite a bit about him, but I still want to know more.
Yeah.
I know that the two key promoters in Los Angeles, not promoters, the two key bookers were Leo Garibaldi and Charlie Motto. Mm-hmm. Jeff Walton says that he thinks Leo Garibaldi's the best booker he ever saw in his life, and with Charlie Motto being a close second. I would love to be able to see a timeline of who booked what in Los Angeles.
Hell, for every territory.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's very true because, you know, so many territories, you didn't have the same person booking year after year. The book would go to different people quite frequently. You know, then you got to see people's underlying talent. And I'm really looking forward to reading Gary Hart's book just because, man, I just got a little sampling of what's inside that brain of his, and I want to know more. Just,
and he also, you know, he booked Texas like for like 6 or 7 straight years too, without burning out. So
yeah, and I loved in that DVD just how candid he was about everything. And he was one of those people who, when he was critical, it was never just sour grapes. It was very matter of fact. You know, whether you'd agree with what he was saying or not, you thought, here's some guy who's really thought out everything he does.
He's also very interesting to watch on the WWE World Class DVD too. You know, just fascinating.
Yeah, I've yet to see that, believe it or not.
And also, I also have some Gary Hart DVDs I made. I could send those to you. Just
I would love to see those. Because I heard shortly before his death, he did a lot of guest booker type interviews.
Yeah, he did a guest booker thing for KFIG commentaries, which I haven't seen. But yeah. So next up, though, is someone that Gary Hart was not a fan of, Jerry Jarrett. But I would say Jerry Jarrett absolutely should be.
Oh, definitely Jerry Jarrett. I have such a fondness for Tennessee wrestling, even though I've never been there, never saw it live. But Tennessee wrestling was almost like the southern version of LA wrestling. Very over the top, very campy. I found it so ironic when I read Bret Hart's autobiography.
Yeah.
He really ran down Memphis wrestling.
Well, it seems like a lot of people in the business were not fans of Tennessee wrestling.
Yeah, they're not. What was so ironic about Bret Hart running down Tennessee wrestling is he really ran down the people who went to the matches, talking about them as if they were these inbred hicks.
From a guy who worked in Calgary for the first several years of his career, right?
Yeah, who worked several in Calgary and described the retarded people screwing in the bleachers
and naming the resulting children after their favorite Stampede wrestlers.
Yes, exactly, and it seemed very, very two-faced. Talking about Memphis as if it was any different. Yeah, but I think you either love Memphis or hate it. I've always found the whole subculture of Memphis wrestling just to be fascinating. I guess I shouldn't just say Memphis, but Tennessee, Kentucky, it has such a unique history to it.
It
was high camp, just like Los Angeles wrestling, just with an extreme southern flair to it.
And Jarrett, I mean, he was great at formatting TV and, you know, coming up with stuff like the music videos, which, you know, I was really the first to a territory to do it in a big way, even though, you know, a couple did it beforehand. Like, you know, Beauregard did his one video in Portland, but, you know, he did it in a big way. You know, it made the Fabulous Ones who they were. And, I mean, he wasn't a good payoff guy, but he was able to keep a territory going into 1997.
Yeah, he kept it. Yeah, he kept it going in a very hearty sense. I mean, you know, Memphis wrestling was fun. I heard there were some periods where the payoffs weren't bad. Like, I heard they had a stretch in 1982 where the wrestlers were getting really nice payoffs, but then it came to an abrupt end, I want to say in 83, something like that.
It was 83 when they had the deal, like, for the whole summer, they drew, like, 7,500 fans or more, something like that, for every Mid-South Coliseum show.
Okay, yeah.
And it was sort of like, that was, you know, he actually had a surplus of talent, which led to the trade with Bill Watts, because he had, like, a lot, you know, he was running two shows a night then and everything. And so, yeah, it was maybe right after that where there was maybe a drop-off, because that was probably the peak that era.
Because I knew several people who worked the territory and were actually, like, really happy with the apartments they were put in, were really happy with the money they were making. And then the following year, just one day, the party was over. So, you know, the payoff suddenly went kabang. I think he's a shoo-in, though, as far as Hall of Fame. I mean, there's no doubt.
So next is Gorilla Monsoon, who... As an announcer, I don't know, and as a backstage figure, whatever his influence was, I don't know, but it's almost like if you put them together, then maybe, yeah.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the odd ones, is that, in my opinion, there are very few people more painful to listen to do commentary than Gorilla Monsoon, but at the same time, there was something very likable about him, and
yeah.
It wasn't just me, I know. People loved Gorilla Monsoon, and it was actually fun once Bobby Heenan got into the mix.
All those primetime wrestling shows.
Yes, yeah, though that was enjoyable. On the fence, but I say put him in.
Yeah,
he was a big figure there. He seemed to make a big splash as a wrestler, too. I not a very good worker. I actually saw some 8mm footage of him working L.A., and he was even a worse worker than he was announcer, but he had appeal. I mean, you know, for that matter, if you will actually watch what footage there is of Bruno Sammartino matches, you know, really not a good worker, especially when you see him throw a punch, but you can never argue how loved he is and just what iconic symbol he is.
Yeah.
And Gorilla Monsoon on a smaller level, but he's kind of a piece of wrestling in the WWF.
Yeah, that's kind of a good way to look at it. I mean, I would like to know more about what he did as far as booking and all that, but
you get
the impression that he was a big part of it.
That was my impression. Yeah, that's my impression too. Where somebody like Lou Albano was kind of almost like a fabulous moolah. He was there because he was there. People dug him, and from what I heard, he didn't really add anything to, you know, the promotion. I mean, he could just kind of was Lou Albano. And in fact, I heard when Vince Jr. took over, he used to give Vince Jr. a hard time and just made it hard to get work
done. Oh, your dad said you can never fire me.
Blah, yeah, blah. Exactly. You know, that doesn't sound like somebody who really contributed a lot, where, you know, Gorilla Monsoon seemed like a, you know, real piece of the promotion.
So next is Dr. Alfonso Morales, who I think would say is a pretty easy yes.
Yeah, that's a very easy yes. You know, I'm embarrassed to say, as a Lucha Libre fan, my Spanish is just a little bit better than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
but one of the great advantages I had when I started really getting into it again in the late 1980s was when I made the Tijuana trips about once a month, one of the people who went with us was Pat Howard, who XPW fans remember as Larry Rivera.
And I had no idea that's who Pat Hoad is.
Yes,
really?
Yes.
I knew the name from tape trading and stuff, but really?
And if you want to hear something funny, is I don't know if you ever heard the story about how his Larry Rivera character came about, was when we would go to Tijuana, we would reminisce about the old days of L.A. wrestling, and we'd talk about the John Tolis-Victor Rivera feud.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who remembers L.A. wrestling, Victor Rivera was a hysterical interview. Not that he was a great interview, but his English was broken. And, you know, while he was really over with the fans, he would, it was comical because he'd say things. I tell you, John Tortoise, I get you. I jump and I jump and I beat you and pin you for victory. And I'm doing a terrible impression of it, but Pat Howard did the funniest Victor Rivera impersonation. And every trip, it never passed. The evening never ended where we said, you know, Pat, do Victor Rivera, please. We probably drove him crazy with it. But then when we started doing Incredibly Strange Wrestling, he would do the commentating with Danny Wolf. And they started, I don't know where the Larry part came in, but they called him Larry Abdullah Rivera, the long lost cousin of Victor Rivera. And he just started doing the commentating, and the rest was history. But what was really fun about going on these trips with Pat Howard was he would talk about the matches we saw on Galavision the previous week and just talk about Dr. Alfonso Morales's style of narration and the historical references he made. Now, I know whenever he made a reference to American wrestling, it wasn't always accurate, but when he made references to any figure in Mexico, he remembered, you know, dates and wrestlers flawlessly and really knew how to, you know, get over the wrestlers on TV. So he's one of those guys that, yeah, he should be in.
And even not speaking Spanish, he just has a great delivery.
He does, yes. Yes, he does. Even if you don't speak a lick of it, he makes the show enjoyable.
So next is Don Owen, who I think we covered yesterday.
Yeah, we did. He should be in. I know a lot of people disagree with me. I know one of the arguments people make is he never promoted really big arenas or something like that. My argument is he didn't have to. He ran a territory for decades and decades, and he made good money doing it. He had a solid draw too. I think the largest arena was probably Portland Sports Arena, which was probably only a few thousand. But, he made money. The wrestlers, you know, I don't think they got rich, but he was not a bad payoff man. And along with Paul Bosch, he's one of the few promoters that most wrestlers had something really nice to say about.
I think, didn't Dave Meltzer say in the Buddy Rose obituary that Rose actually had some years where he made over $100,000, though, in Portland?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I do remember, I knew a few people who worked prelims in there when the territory is still going well, and they were making a lot more than you would working a 9-to-5 job. So I think it was only the last couple of years the promotion was around where the payoffs went low. And, you know, that's when Tom Peterson, who was one of the key sponsors, filed for bankruptcy. He paid them well. And Buddy Rose did make really good money there. A lot of guys made good money there.
And also, really, anyone that came into the promotion got a chance.
Yes, they did. They did. And you know, one thing I remember about the year I lived in Oregon was Eugene was just one of the towns, but no matter when I went, I would never leave. I'd never leave the place thinking, oh, I saw a shitty night of wrestling. There was always something good on those shows. The openers were usually anywhere from okay to really good. The main events, you know, the continuity, even the smaller towns, week to week was, you know, done well, really well executed, just as effective as if they were promoting a match in the main city, Portland. And, you know, I mean, Don Owens, I think, didn't do big arenas because he didn't have to. I think he had a good thing going and promoted what he promoted, and he did it really well. I think he's a shoo-in.
Next up is Roy Shire, who I guess you could say is a similar candidate to Jim Crockett, who had such a bad end that people forget about how high he took everything before
that. He had some strong years, and not just two or three strong years. He had a solid territory going there. I got to see some of, you know, the Shire TV tapings and some of the live shows when I was a teenager, because my dad and I went up to Sacramento, the Sacramento area a lot. And that was one of those areas that was interesting. They had a really good following. They do really good live crowds. And it was kind of funny because while the wrestling, you know, it was TV studio wrestling, and while the work rate was really good on TV, one of the people who remembers that romantic era, one of the things they forget was one of the campiest things was they had a canned audience. There would be, you'd see the audience sitting there motionless during a match, but the whole time you'd hear this rabid TV studio full of people cheering, yeah, go get him, boo, yeah. Boo. And sometimes you'd even hear the names mentioned of wrestlers who weren't wrestling in the ring at that time from the audience. So despite that extreme campy aspect to it, Shires had a really good territory, had really good angles on TV. And that was also the first time I ever saw Playboy Buddy Rose, who was, you know, already a natural at being a heel. And yeah, you're absolutely right in that. His last few years, I think some people kind of remember those better than, you know, his rich years, his, you know, I mean, he was similar to Mike LaBelle. He had the annual Battle Royal, which was a sellout almost every year, I think. And it's funny to think, I mean, now it's the Royal Rumble, but that's a big deal. But back then, there were several regions that would have annual Battle Royals, which, you know, were like the highlight of every wrestling fan's year.
Well, even the Royal Rumble, I think Pat Patterson came up with it sort of as the successor to the annual San Francisco or Los Angeles Battle Royal.
Oh, was it Pat Patterson's brainchild? Because that makes sense.
Well, yeah, he's the one. He was always in charge of booking and laying out the Royal Rumble.
Yeah, I remember a friend of mine going up to him about 15 years back and asking him what was his favorite booking accomplishment. He said booking the Royal Rumble. He said it was the most complicated type of match he ever booked. Yeah, Roy Shire, I say, should go in. I heard he wasn't the most pleasant individual in the world. I hear he is kind of an asshole. But, you know, great promoter.
Yeah, and I think even with the last few years, I think, I forget what the context was, but I think I saw Dave Meltzer write once that even like the Bob Roop and Kevin Sullivan feud near the end actually drew really well, like almost as well as even like the famous Ray Stevens feuds, but just that people don't remember it well.
Yeah, that was in 1977. I remember that was a pretty well done feud, and that was when Kevin Sullivan was, you know, all-American babyface type. And, yeah, they had a great chemistry together, I thought. I saw a lot of the TV from around that time. The Von Steigers were also some of the top heels. I had heard that that came to a sudden halt because, I don't know the exact story, but I heard that Root and Sullivan tried to make some sort of political power play to get Rorschach's territory from him. I don't know how they would have gone about doing that.
Well, that doesn't surprise me with Bob Roop, though, considering all the different outlaw stuff he did.
Yeah, yeah. I could see them trying to do it. I'm just trying to think, how do you go about taking somebody like Roy Shire? How do you take his territory from him? How do you actually accomplish it? Because he had such strong ties there. But I guess it could be done. But that's what I heard, is that that was the end of that honeymoon. And then the following year, 1978, or even toward the end of 77, is I think when they started pushing people like Ron Starr. Oh, and who was he feuding with? He eventually started feuding with people like Piper, but he feuded with some other people before
that. Didn't they have Ron Pope in there, I think?
Ron Pope was there. They started to give him a push, but Pope had a really cool look to him, very cool look, but was...
That was it.
Terrible worker. Although when I was a little kid and I saw him as Mighty Zulu, people were really smart in booking him, where they'd have him do really short matches where he was so strong he'd just clamp a full Nelson on guys. And that was like the gimmick. Mm-hmm. And when I was a little kid, I thought he was really cool. I enjoyed watching him wrestle even though he sucked. But, you know, if they booked him correctly, you didn't know he sucked as a little kid who doesn't understand that the reason, you know, people who win their matches in short succession is because they're not good workers, and you would just want to get them in and out as fast as you can. So I thought Pope had a definite charisma to him, but yeah, he was a terrible, terrible worker, and he burned a lot of bridges that he shouldn't have burned.
Yeah. So last on the ballot is Jesse Ventura, who, I don't know. I mean,
it's weird. I think he should be in, but I was never a big fan of his. I just never dug him. But I don't know. It's almost hard to argue. He did make his mark. He's, as far as a non-wrestler, yeah.
Yeah.
As a wrestler, no.
Yeah, I mean, as a non-wrestler, yeah, I mean, I guess so. Although, sometimes I feel too much like there are people who want him to get in because he became governor.
Yeah, I think that aside, he made a big enough mark as the heel announcer. And for a while, I thought he was very good at it, even though I didn't dig him that much. He just didn't do that much for me, but I am in the vast minority, and I know it's purely subjective on my part. I'm sure there's some people who, as good as the Grand Wizard was, thought he wasn't all that, but would still admit that, hey, he had it. And that's me. He just didn't do anything for me personally. But as far as making the mark in the business, yeah, I think he belongs in.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I did like, too, was that he would praise certain baby faces.
I'm sorry?
He would, as a heel commentator, he would praise certain baby faces. Like, he'd always put over the Bulldogs.
Yeah, a heel announcer, it's easy to just do this really over-the-top, campy job. But I thought he really got over... He got over the wrestling itself, too.
Right.
I remember, because they would do the heel announcer gimmick sometimes in L.A., and what I remember most about it was purely an angle. It was never done for a long period of time. They had Crusher Verdue as the heel commentator, and it was purely an angle to have people want to, you know, get him in the ring and feed him his lunch.
How was he on commentary? Because I know he wasn't supposed to be a very good wrestler.
No, he wasn't. You know what? He's one of those wrestlers who was not good, but I liked him. I don't know what it was about him. He was fun to watch. As the heel announcer, he was actually quite funny, which I guess was kind of the wrong intention because they were trying to get him heat. But it kind of cracked you up because most of it was in Spanish, so a lot of it I couldn't understand. But he would cut some of the interviews in English, and he would sit there and just start, you know, praising his own laurels about all the stuff he accomplished, and would just laugh humbly as if he were his own grandfather, saying, I am really so proud of myself, I don't know what to say. And one of the things that did get heat that was actually quite funny is Gene LaBelle would try to explain to him that the job of a commentator was to be, use objectivity and, and he says, I want to thank you for that advice, Mr. LaBelle. Now, I have a little advice for you, too. And he smacks Gene LaBelle across the face. And Gene LaBelle just stands there staring at him. And usually Gene LaBelle did stuff that was over the top and you just laugh it. But he just stood there frozen and stared at him like, I want to kick your ass so bad. And it actually really worked. And then one thing that got over more funny than heated is one of the things he did as the official commentator of LA Wrestling was he told Jeff Walton, Mr. Walton, you look terrible in your glasses. I want you to take them off. And Jeff Walton, it just came off too comical. He said, it was just like, yes, but you know what, Mr. Verdue? If I don't wear my glasses, I can't see very well. So if I take them off, I won't be able to see. And so
that sounds like it's from a like instructional film for kids telling not to call people four eyes.
That's exactly what it sounds. It's exactly how it came off. And then the following week, Verdue comes on and says, I thought I told you, Mr. Walton, I do not like your glasses. And Walton says, but like I told you last week, if I don't wear my glasses, I cannot see very well. And so you can see what's coming a mile away. He takes Walton's glasses off, places them on the ground, and steps on them. And the whole time Walton's going, no, Mr. Verdue, please don't do that to my glasses. I won't be able to see. And then Chavo Guerrero runs out in a rage and starts beating the hell out of Verdue. But it really didn't get any heat because it just – here you see this Chavo looking legitimately enraged over something that was so comical. But I guess it was effective, maybe not in drawing a crowd, but it left a wonderful memory in my mind. I almost wish I had that on tape.
Question for you. I mean, I mentioned this on the other show I did the other day with Rob Naylor, because it came off talking about Ivan Koloff, that in Gary Hart's book, he mentions, you know, he's working in Australia, and Jim Barnett sends him to the Garden to tell him if Ivan Koloff's good enough to main event in Australia, because Vince Sr. had been telling him, oh, you'd love this guy, but he's, you know, we need to get him out of our territory for now to make sure he stays fresh. And so the last thing he tells Gary Hart before he leaves is, don't come bringing me back a Crusher Verdoux.
That's funny. That was when he was doing the Louis Cyr gimmick as a strongman. Oh my God, that's funny. Yeah, he was by no means a good worker, but I remember as a kid digging him. The funniest thing was the Herald Examiner, paper here in L.A. used to actually print the results of wrestling, but they were always very tongue-in-cheek. They were always ridiculing the product. The greatest thing is they said what an uncanny resemblance that Crusher Verdoux had to Mr. Magoo. And it was so true. And I never thought of it, but if you ever see pictures of him, his eyes are squinted all the time like that, and he had the same exact smile as Mr. Magoo. And what was the other one? When Piper got his head shaved, they said, like, Dobie Gillis's return, but not to the TV waves. And it was funny, when Piper's head was shaved when he was so skinny, he looked exactly like Dobie Gillis.
That reminds me of the thing in Bret Hart's book where he says that the Barbarian looked, and I think acted, like a muscled-up version of Grover.
Yeah.
And then I realized, yeah. Oh my God, that's true.
That is true. That's true. I love it when you see those comparisons. And once you get an association like that, it's almost hard to think of him as a terrifying heel afterwards.
Yeah. And terrifying in real life, too. But...
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I've tried to figure out over the years now if he, like, well, if he was the toughest of the various Polynesian guys, or which was the tougher wife, his wife or Liam Ivia. But
oh yeah, I know that. Those are such intriguing stories when you hear about those wives being tougher than a lot of the active wrestlers, and you know, makes me, oh, man. I'm glad I never tried wrestling full time, because I'm sure, you know, with my luck, I would have gotten my ass kicked by somebody's wife. That'd be the ultimate humiliation if you're a full time wrestler. I'm glad I stayed an indie geek, as people put it.
Plus, you're in California, so you would have run into enough Samoans that it would have happened eventually.
Exactly. I think I would have just paid him off to be my bodyguard. What's her name? Mount Fiji.
Yeah, from Glow.
Even Glow. She's one of our Southern California gals. I would have paid her off to she made her splash in non-wrestling fame out here in Southern California when I think it was her wedding party, but her bridal shower was raided by the police.
Oh.
And the police tried to paint it like all these Samoans were beating the hell out of them, but a neighbor across the street videotaped it and saw that the police were just breaking in and essentially smacking them around.
Why did they raid the wedding in the first place?
Good question. It's like a noise complaint or something like that.
Okay.
And they just went in there being pricks. And, you know, it's one of those things when you first hear the cry of police abuse, you say, yeah, maybe. But then you see the video and you're saying, well, yeah, it's true a lot of the times.
Yeah, well, based on what we've heard, it would probably not take even a lot of them to beat up all the cops based on the stories.
It wouldn't. And the scary thing is they were really trying to peacefully disperse from what you saw in the video. Mm-hmm. And there were also witnesses. People came in the ambulance, and one of the EMTs said, I saw somebody videotaping if you need evidence, like we know what was going on. And they actually won the lawsuit and won the appeal. And Mount Fiji and several of her family members have a nice sum, actually, in this case, a very deserved sum after what they had to go through.
That's an interesting story.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the end of the Hall of Fame ballot. I would guess
we got through it. We've done our own Iron Man match.
Yeah, it took about 4 hours total, but...
Oh, rocking. I had a great time.
Me too.
I hope the people listening enjoy it too.
Yeah, and I hope we definitely get to do something like this again soon.
I would too. I want to thank you, because I had a blast doing it. Not only was it fun just chatting up with you, like I said, I now have a list of books I want to read. I have a ton of DVDs I want to see. It's just kind of re-sparked my spirit to see some, you know, good wrestling again.
Well, pleasure's all mine, Kurt. So I'd like to thank you for doing this. I'll be in touch, and I'd like to thank everyone for listening. Again, you know, check out cagesideseats.com for all your latest various wrestling and MMA news and opinions and odd history and YouTube videos and whatnot, and also the archive of old shows on loserleavestown.net or davidbix.com, and I guess that's about it. So thanks, everybody, and goodbye.